We'll now call upon Mr. Mark Hunter to deliver his address, Choose Life.
Worked. Survival of the fittest is a concept that Darwinians have put forward as a foundational concept in their world philosophy. And it's pretty easy to understand. And one of the most common examples they give is that of the giraffe. And you think, well, the giraffe, eats leaves. And so if a giraffe is born with a longer neck, then clearly they can reach more leaves. And so the shorter giraffes sadly die, and the longer neck giraffes grow up to be even longer necked. And this repeats over the generations. And so therefore, they're the fittest giraffes. And you think of the elephants. Well, the big elephants are at lower risk of predation by the lions, right? The lion's going to have trouble with a really big elephant. So the bigger the elephant, the safer it is. And therefore, bigger is better, right? And so the fittest elephants survive. And you think of a little mouse, and you go, well, the little mouse, the littler is better because he can scurry in the little corners, right? And he can conceal himself from predators. And so in that case, the fittest mouse is the littlest mouse who can hide the best. But you'll notice there's a little bit of a catch here, because I thought we just said that bigger was better, and now we're saying that littler is better. They can't both be right. So is it bigger or is it littler? Like, which actually is better? And so this becomes a little bit of a problem in this theory of survival of the fittest. So let me adjust the font size here. A biologist tries to explain this in an article, I think, on Nature magazine, Nature website. He says, what is fitness? In its common usage, the term fitness is connected with the idea of being in shape, and associated physical attributes like strength, endurance, or speed. This is quite different from its use in biology. To an evolutionary biologist, fitness simply means reproductive success. Okay, keep that in mind. This is going to be a key concept. To an evolutionary biologist, fitness means reproductive success. So what are we to make of this phrase, survival of the fittest? After all, if fitness just means relative reproductive success, then the phrase becomes survival of the successful reproducers. And since survival is understood as reproductive success, this simply becomes the reproductive success of the successful reproducers, reducing this great theory into a complicated way of saying that creatures that survive, survive. Okay, so keep that in mind. When they say survival of the fittest, it sounds like there's an explanation of something, but all they're saying is that, well, survival means, you know, you had kids, and fittest means, well, you had kids. So the creatures that have kids have kids. That's actually the information content of survival of the fittest, okay? It sounds like it's explaining something, but it actually isn't explaining anything. Now, he senses this. This is called the tautology, and he tries to explain it in the next paragraph, and he says, organisms which are better suited to their environment will reproduce more. Guess how you know if an organism is better suited to its environment? If it reproduces more. So he tries to get himself out of this bag, and he can't quite talk himself out of this bag. But what is clear is, from an evolutionary biologist's perspective, reproductive success is the key. Okay, they tie themselves into knots on how to explain anything, but at the end of the day, do you have kids, and do your kids have kids? That's really what is the fundamental premise of the whole theory of evolution. Now, There's a little nuance here. In the case of an ant colony, only the queen has kids, but all the other creatures in the ant colony are supporting the queen in the mission of having kids. So really it's, does your community support reproductive success? Does your community support family values, if you want to think of it from an evolutionary perspective? So let's come back to the Bible. This is supposed to be a Bible address. Genesis 1, 27, 28. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. There's an interesting harmony going on here. Jesus endorses this notion in Matthew 19. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. And then the verse we read tonight, I call heaven and earth to witness today against you that I have placed before you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life that you may live and your descendants. Intergenerational life is what is on offer in this chapter of Deuteronomy. So there's an unusual collaboration here between the Darwinians and the Christians and the Jews, right? In theory, on this topic, we should all agree that we should establish a society that promotes life in an intergenerational way. And if you think of, well, somebody who you might run into in the street, what are the odds that they are either believe in the theory of evolution or are Christian or are Muslim or are Jewish? Right? That's a lot of people. I would venture to say that is the vast majority of people in the Western world fall into one of those categories. So all of those people, billions, should be in agreement that life and intergenerational life is one of the highest values that should be aspired to by their culture. And if you look out in the world, you go, wow, that's, you know, this is a picture of a random intersection and every red box identifies something to do with protecting life. You know, you got little gutters along the side of the street to distinguish where cars should go to make sure somebody doesn't get run over. And we paint little lines on the street so that you know where to walk so that you don't walk in the wrong way. There's lights installed to make sure cars stop and go at the right time. There's a little, fence around the sidewalk there so you don't cross the wrong way. There's a little balcony with a little fence. This is only the visible signs of safety and life here. There were architects who made sure that these buildings were built correctly. The slope of the roof has to be correct. There are sewer systems to protect us from disease. Material engineers to make sure that the bricks can hold the proper, like, our society invests a tremendous amount in life. The richer your country, the more you, like, crash tests and all kinds of investments in life. But that's not the only thing that it said in Deuteronomy 30. It said, choose life in order that you may live and your descendants. That's a pretty crucial element. So how should we determine if a society is focusing on life for its descendants? Well, I decided to start by going to the happiest place on earth, which surprisingly was not Disneyland, but it's actually Finland. For many years running, Finland has stood out as the happiest country on earth. And I said, well, how is Finland doing for its descendants? And this is a chart of the fertility rate in Finland. And this number here too, just above it, 2.1, is the replacement rate for humans. For a human population to sustain itself in a multi-generational sense, you must have a fertility rate of at least 2.1. Anything less than that, and you're in trouble. As a population, you are in trouble. You are in decline. From an evolutionary biologist perspective, Finland is in trouble. Okay? They're under 1.5. So we can shake our finger at the people in Finland. So, well, how are we doing in Canada? Well, Canada, not so good, right? Just under 1.5. It turns out that even though all these Canadians theoretically believe in life and in intergenerational life, in actual practice, we're not living up to our belief system. And what is the worst place in the world in this respect? South Korea, their fertility rate has dropped below 1. In fact, I went to their latest stats, and this is a complicated chart, but the fertility rate is down here, 0.78 is their fertility rate, the lowest on earth. Now, you go to South Korea, you would think, oh, what a thriving, awesome society. Their fertility rate is 37% of what is needed just to break even. Now, it's a little hard to conceive of the number, so let me explain it to you. Imagine you have 1,000 South Koreans, and they are only going to have 370 children, right? It's 37% of what you need for that next generation to survive. And those 370, 380 are only going to have 145 children. So within two generations, you're going to go from 1,000 people to 145. And on the third generation, you have about 50 kids. You have 50 kids with 1,500 parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents. Like, this is a population devastation vastly worse than the plague. Right? This is an absolute population catastrophe from an evolutionary perspective. Now, the problem is it's unfolding in slow motion, so everybody's so busy doing their thing that they're not noticing that basically it's the end of the world as they know it. Now, about half the countries in the world are facing this problem at some level. Guess how many have managed to dip down below 2.1, have realized there's a problem, and have been able to come back up? Not one. None of the countries who have dropped below replacement rate have been able to sustain a recovery. There's a little bit, you know, when they drop just below 2.1, sometimes there's a little bit of a bouncing along, and then they go down. So I collected a dozen or so countries, and I'll have to turn around here because the print's too small. We've got Finland, Denmark, Switzerland, New Zealand, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Austria, Australia, USA, Russia, Canada, China. Right? All those people in China. China's in trouble. Germany, France, UK, Italy, Japan, South Korea. All of these countries and dozens more are doomed. They're all on the same trajectory. It's just a matter of at what speed they're going downhill. Keep an eye out for headlines. These are headlines just from the last few months. China's first population fall since 1961 creates bleak outlook for the country. The shift is occurring nearly a decade ahead of forecasts. So they've anticipated population dropping. What's happening is the rate of population collapse is accelerating. And the pandemic didn't help. China used to have a one-child policy, then they finally woke up and they went, whoa, two children, you're going to have two children. Didn't make a difference. So if you can have three children, didn't make a difference. Now they're like, we're going to offer child care. We're going to do... Doesn't make a difference. China's population, this is a National Geographic, China's population is shrinking. It faces a perilous future. We've always said, will China get rich before it gets old? This was the question for China. And the answer appears to be no. They're going to get old before they're going to get rich. And they're going to have a huge wave of retirees and not enough workers to support them. Japan will disappear without action on birth. This is the prime minister's aide. This isn't just some crackpot guy off in the corner. This is somebody who assists the prime minister of Japan is going, this country is doomed. There are more adult diapers sold in Japan than there are children's diapers. Right? There are empty villages. They're closing schools constantly. Russia's population crisis is making Putin more dangerous. It's a Washington Post article from last month. Russia is in a demographic death spiral. In the long term, that's bad news for Russia. In the short term, it's bad news for Russia's neighbors. There is an argument out there that part of the reason Putin invaded Ukraine is because he knows the writing is on the wall. Russia will never be stronger than it is now. Deaths have outpaced births almost every year since the end of communism. Russia's population peaked in 1993. 30 years ago was the peak of Russian population. Putin is acutely conscious of the problem and talks about it all the time. He has tried in vain all the normal ways to reverse the trend, from offering financial incentives for citizens to have more children to trying to lure immigrants from Central Asia. This is the population growth chart of Russia. All this is population loss. They had a tiny bit of gain, and now it's cash. And look, that's 2021. They had a full year of catastrophic massacring of their prime reproductive stock, if you want to think of humans that way. Never mind a million people who left the country. Russia is toast. Evolutionary biologists will tell you that the key to the survival of the species is reproductive success. And from an evolutionary perspective, this force is overwhelmingly powerful. Now, I want you to think for a second about eyebrows. Because evolutionists think we came from monkeys, right? So they think we used to have hair all over our foreheads. And now we only have hair on these little strips. And so you have to ask yourselves, what happened to all the people who had extra hair, right? Whose hair didn't contain itself just to this strip. And what an evolutionist will tell you is they're dead. Every one of them is dead. Because the survival difference of having just that extra hair there kills you, right? All those people are dead. And all the people who went too far and lost their eyebrows altogether, you know what happened to all of them? They're all dead. Because if you have an evolutionary pressure of not having enough hairs above your eyeballs, that's it. That's it for you, for your kids, your grandkids, and your lineage for infinity. That's how powerful evolution is, the people who believe in evolution, right? Consider this water louse. On the left is what a water louse looks like on the surface, and on the right is what a water louse looks like in a cave after some amount of time, right? And they're both water lice. How come they're all white? Well, an evolutionist will tell you that the extra energy that it took a water louse to make itself a little bit brown was too much, right? That's it. It killed them. All the brown water lice died because they were wasting that tiny little bit of energy. That's how strong and ruthless evolution is to an evolutionary biologist. So, with that in mind, take your imagine you're looking at the world through the eyes of an evolutionary biologist, and then look at humans and consider human populations which destroy millions of their children willingly, which actively discourage heterosexual family values, which fill their youth with terrible fears of catastrophe, which fill their cultures with economic interest as the highest value, and which virtualize social networks. What do you think is going to happen to those populations from an evolutionary perspective?
They'll die.
Oh, thank you. Right? If having too much hair on your forehead was enough to wipe out an entire line of humanity, imagine putting all of these pressures on human populations. What is the spell for the future of human populations? And I'm using their own philosophy to prophesy this. I haven't even gone to the Bible. We know what the Bible says, right? About these kinds of things. We know that the Bible says you have a choice and some choices lead to life. But if you put that aside for the moment and you go, based on your own philosophy, humans out there, what does the future look like for the species? Looks terrible. Wall Street Journal and some other organization did a poll on which values are important to people. And in 1998, if you remember that other chart, by 1998, we're already in big demographic catastrophe zone. And since then, people care less about patriotism. They care less about religion. They care less about having children. They care less about community involvement. They do care more about money. So on top of all the evolutionary and social and whatever pressure, it's only gotten worse since 1998. In fact, there's a famous YouTuber called Hank Green. He makes a YouTube series called Crash Course. What he does is great. Like, these are great 20-minute snippets of history and other things like that. And so his audience is young adults on the internet. And he went on Twitter and he said, which universe is the better one? One with humans or one without humans? And this guy has millions of followers. Now, there's only, coincidentally, 66,006. I didn't intentionally pick it when there was a 666 in the number of votes so far. It just worked out that way. But 40% of his audience doesn't even want humans in the universe. He doesn't understand it. Right? He's sitting there going, I keep trying to do versions of this poll thinking that there's something wrong with the question. That he keeps asking this question in different ways because he's like, clearly people must be misunderstanding me. It cannot be true that in modern society, 40% of people don't want there to be any humans anymore. But he keeps doing the poll and he keeps discovering that humanity has lost faith in itself. In fact, this is which countries are above replacement rate in population growth and which countries are below replacement rate. Did I do that in the right order? I built this slide first about a year and a half ago, and since I built the slide, Mexico fell below replacement rate, Burma fell below replacement rate, Iran fell below replacement rate, and Tunisia fell below replacement rate. It took all of 18 months to lose another four countries. Now, pop quiz. In the countries that are still above replacement rate, there is only one modern sort of Western advanced economy. Only one. It stands out amongst all the sort of third world developing nations. Anybody venture a guess on which country sort of bucks the trend? Israel. We find prophecy everywhere, right? But if you're a demographer and you're looking at the stats, like there's a big glowing light here that says one of these is not like the other. There's something fundamentally different about Jewish culture that manifests itself in a demographic chart of the world. It's fascinating. Western civilization is a zombie civilization. It's dead. It's over. It's gonna keep walking for a while, thinking that it's alive, because it doesn't even know that it's dead yet. But the fact is, this civilization, as we observe it unfolding around us, there is no way that it can survive. And I mean biblically, and I mean secularly. There is no example of a surviving population, of a surviving culture. Now, maybe it could change. And when I challenge people on this, they're like, well, things could change in the future. Sure, they could, right? That's a statement of faith, first of all. It's interesting. They're making a statement of faith. Like, well, can you find me one example of a country that changed? No, but maybe someday they'll decide to think. But if they do, that's going to be a different culture than the one we have today, right? So it would have to be a different culture. The culture we have today is a dead culture. And the reason I think this is important for us to remember is because there's a lot of very eloquent, good-looking, talking heads out there who are talking down at you and telling you that you're a bunch of backwards, you know, primitive believers and superstitious whatever, and that they have the answers, and that they figured it out, that they know how you should live, that they know how society should be organized. And they've succeeded in organizing these societies across 100 and some odd cultures, countries, and every one that they've organized is dying. We've got governments. We have the answer. We know how to do things. All the governments are failing. The conservative ones, the liberal ones, everything in between, all human governments are failing on this front. We've got educational institutions. They're all failing. We've got economic institutions. They're all failing. We've got entertainment institutions. They're all failing. We've got scientific institutions. They're all failing. We've got religious. We've got media organizations. All of these groups come to you and tell you that they know better than you, that they're clever, that they figured it all out. And they are all part of a zombie culture that is dying or dead, and they don't even realize it yet. It sounds good, but it's rotten inside. And if you ever feel that pull, like what they're saying sounds nice, like it makes sense, remember, collectively, the beliefs of the modern society are a dead end. Self-contradictory, self-destructive, and it's getting worse. Now, I want to add a little bit of nuance here, coming back to sort of more of the religious angle. You might say, well, you have 5 kids. You're just standing up there wagging the finger because you're like, oh, we, you know, somehow you're special. So I just want to clarify, we didn't plan our family saying what we're going to do is we're going to have 5 kids because we want to champion the humanity. No, it's sort of just one at a time. It was not a moral, ethical decision that we were conscious in that sense. We both come from families with only 2 children. We can't even blame our parents for it. We saw earlier that Jesus endorses marriage. He also endorses not getting married. Just for the record, he says, there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by people, and there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The one who is able to accept this, let him accept this. I don't want you to interpret the information that I'm putting out there tonight to say that people who have more kids are more righteous than people who don't. That's not the statement, right? What we're saying is that at a population level, at a broad community level, there are societies and cultures that promote life, and there are those that don't. And just like we saw with the aunties and the aunts, right? You can either directly participate in life, or you can support a community that promotes life. And that also is life-giving. And Jesus makes the point in Matthew 3, looking around at those who were sitting with him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God, this is my brother and sister and mother. At the spiritual level, the important family is the spiritual family, right? We're not in some kind of competitive racial situation where we want more of our kind of kids than their kind of kids. Like that is not what I'm talking about here. All we're observing is broadly, the culture out there says that they have things figured out, but clearly they don't. Every time somebody comes to you with some kind of message or philosophy that they propose to you is better, remember this chart. Remember this chart. Ask them to explain, if this belief system that you hold is true, why are the people who believe it going extinct? Now, we might ask ourselves, why is it? Right? It sounds good. And I think this is a little bit of supposition. It comes down to the faith of a mother. And when you think of it, what has changed in the last 40, 50 years? And so there's some things that have changed for the better and some for the worse. And in the modern world, a mother or a mother-to-be has tremendously more decision-making power than at any other point in time in history. And so when a mother goes to make a decision to say, do I want to take on the risk and the burden of another life for 20, 30 years, and maybe times two, and really times three sometimes, in order to sustain the population, you need a social cocoon which will give that woman faith in her society, in her culture, and in her social safety net to say, I think I can do this. I think this group, whether it's her husband or her husband and the community around her, will support her over a 20 and 30 year period of great vulnerability and cost. And I think collectively across half the planet, mothers are doing the math and saying, I don't trust society. I don't trust the men in their lives. Right? They don't trust the men. They don't trust the social networks. They don't trust the governments. They don't trust their communities. Not enough to make that enormous gamble. And you know what? I don't blame them. I am not criticizing the decision of any one of these women, because if we look at what society is encouraging, it's no wonder, right? We've eroded the family structure that was built to protect women through these vulnerable periods. And so women have made the natural choice. And they said, you know what? You know what's the safest route for me right now? Is to have a good career, Because then I don't have to depend on all these parts of society which I can no longer depend on. And it's a tragedy. All the language out there that is supposedly, you know, in favor of women and supportive of women, when it comes down to the math of what choices do women actually make, nobody believes it. I don't mean nobody, but at a population level, society does not have faith in itself. And that spells its doom. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have placed before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants. This is the filter that we need to use when we consider our lives and the choices we make. Are we making choices of life for you? That's the first layer. Are you making choices that sustain life, not just in a selfish way, but in a spiritual way, in every dimension? And then you need to broaden that and say, are you making choices that support multi-generational life? Are you contributing to a life-giving fabric that enables and empowers life for others? And that is what Scripture calls us to. And don't be seduced by the empty rhetoric of the world who will come to you and tell you that they know better and they've figured it all out, but their culture is demonstrably a culture of death. Thank you.